Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today, always starting with the latest on positive information on health and nutrition and anti-aging, always from qualified sources. For example, when I talk about a daily chocolate fix reducing heart disease risk, especially in postmenopausal women, that's from Nippon Sports Science University in Japan, published in a major peer-reviewed journal, Clinical Interventions of Aging. Then I'm going to talk about researchers find lactose intolerance, a lot of people have that, is actually related to a low vitamin D level, University of Toronto. And eating corn can prevent cataracts. Well, that's interesting. A university, Kane University in Thailand. And then we're going to look at how switching to a low glycemic diet, that's a good diet, can stop age-related eye disease from Tufts University. And also how ginger, that simple, important herb, can help fight obesity and related disorders from the New York Academy of Sciences. Then I'm going to do commentaries. I've decided not to have a guest today so that we can get a lot of important thoughts into people's minds. From David Rosen from Counterpunch, the war on drugs is a racket. I believe it's time that we, meaning those who have open minds, who are progressive in our ideals, meaning we look for the truth, it's not alignment with ideologies, realize this entire war on drugs is just one giant failure at every level. And I'm going to do it today because the Attorney General is now wanting to get back to the draconian long sentences for drug-related crimes. Well, there shouldn't be a drug-related crime. So we're going to deal with that. Also from Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out, Dancing with the Devil. Also today, we're going to talk about how those people who are on food stamps are really being exploited in ways that we weren't aware. From Mark Anderson from Alternet, quote, jaw-dropping corruption. America's 47 million hungry mouths are just another corporate cash cow. Also today, Harvard investigates, quote, unprecedented academic dishonesty case. Nearly half of more than 250 students in Introduction to Congress are under investigation. So we'll take a look at that. We also are going to look at how we are not dealing with issues that impact our well-being. Why? And from our audio clips today, we're going to deal with all the fish in the Pacific tested thus far is testing positive for radiation. Now, we have a lot of people who listen to me on KPFK for 33 years. 6 hours a week. I haven't been on there in 3.5 years now since I voluntarily took myself off. But we have tens of thousands. Don't eat seaweed. Don't eat anything coming out of the Pacific. It's contaminated. Also, advice from doctors on drinking dairy. And we're going to look at the whole idea of supporting mom-and-pop independent farms instead of big agriculture. I think it's very important. And also from our audio file, if time permits, why is it that with a vital women's movement, and instead of just calling it a feminist movement, I believe we should look at a larger concept of equality movement, because I'm one of those people who believe and always have that women should have absolutely parity and equality in doing anything they want, being compensated. So I don't want this to be a war between men and women. I think that was a mistake for a long time. If you take a step back, you'll find more often than not, it's a war between people based upon who controls both people. We're not looking far enough into this. Now, why is it with the women in America are not universally supporting the women around the world? And what does that mean? And how could that be done so that if you are a woman who appreciates your freedoms and and the support society gives you to exercise those freedoms in the United States or in Canada or in France or in England, Italy, Germany, why are we not supporting the freedom of women's movements in the Middle East? And we're not. Condoleezza Rice didn't. Madeleine Albright didn't. Jean Kilpatrick didn't at the UN. Hillary Clinton certainly didn't. She was the worst enemy of women's rights around the world I've ever met, and probably in American history. She was no Eleanor Roosevelt. So we're going to have a commentary on that today. Why don't women fight for women's rights if they're a Muslim woman? So we have a lot of different things to share, always with the idea of empowering people. And we will. So let's get right to it. Chocolate's good if it's a healthy chocolate. I believe that we should be more conscious of where our chocolate comes from. For example, there are places that are growing cacao, which is chocolate, but they're doing it almost on slave conditions. So make sure that whatever chocolate you're buying, it's fair trade. That not only were people not exploited in doing it, but people were gainfully rewarded. Secondly, that it's organic. Third, that it's kosher. Fourth, that it has no dairy. And lastly, that it's GMO-free, and it also has no refined processed sugars like high fructose corn syrup or sucrose. That said, there's a huge market out there for healthy chocolate. Now, there's at least 70 different studies over the last 10 years supporting that healthy chocolate on a daily basis, generally around 2 ounces, which is not a lot. It can help all different parts of your body. This is from Nippon Sports Science University in Japan. And they found that, quote, daily consumption of flavanol-rich cacao reduced artificial stiffness in the postmenopausal women's arteries, therefore lowering the risk of heart attacks and strokes. Wow, that's a big deal. And they did this in less than 12 weeks. Quote, these findings provide additional evidence that regular ingestion of chocolate, which is cacao, helps to improve cardiovascular health among postmenopausal women. And this was published in the journal Clinical Interventions of Aging. Now, there have been many other studies that have come to similar conclusions. So just I've gave this analogy because it's appropriate. I'll do it again. Remember, we have brand new listeners from all over the world every single day to the show. Visualize a water hose, brand new, pliable. You can roll it up and you can bend it. Now leave it in the sun for 3 months. It's dry and stiff. It doesn't bend. It breaks. That's your arteries. When you're putting in foods like pizzas and hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, bagels, donuts, pretzels, potato chips, these fats and refined carbohydrates and simple sugars and animal proteins, they call what is called glycation. That's glycation, C-A-T-I-O-N. Now, that is the premature aging of your cell. It speeds up your telomeres, which are the protein end caps on chromosomes. And every time they change, you die a little faster. So the quicker the changes of your cells, the quicker that cell dies, goes into what we call senescence. Now, we want to do just the opposite. We want to slow down the aging process of all the cells in the body, including our brain cells, heart cells. So we go from a proglycation, which is pro-inflammatory diet, to an anti-glycation, anti-inflammatory, which means that we eat lots of healthy fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts and seeds, tubers and herbs, and juices, fresh-made juices wherever possible. And if it's a bottled juice, at least get a bottled juice that is not from concentrate, and that is organic. Like a grape juice would be really good. But also sauerkraut juice would be good, and a beet juice is terrific as well. And beet juice is particularly good because the beets have the capacity to create nitric oxide. And by the way, almost all these male sexual enhancement, you know, for erectile dysfunction, it's working on the principle of nitric oxide. But they patented the chemical to do that, and they're charging, I don't know what it is. I was told by someone I was counseling that it was, what, $60 or $70 for a single pill? That's outrageous. A glass of beet juice does the same thing, but actually increases the nitric oxide, helps your arteries, helps a man get an erection. It's all healthy. There's no side effects. Plus, gives you a vegan form of iron, oxygenates the blood, and improves B-complex. Plus, helps with the energy, what is called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, at the cellular level. So you're getting more energy, you're healthier, your blood is thinner, you're less likely to have a stroke from a glass of beet juice. So, and by the way, if you take beet juice with cacao, a piece of chocolate, you're getting a double benefit. So keep that in mind. Now, from the University of Toronto, new research shows that people with genetic intolerance to lactose, the main sugar found in dairy, have lower blood levels of vitamin D than the general population. Quote, we were surprised that lactose intolerant people ate less dairy, but we were surprised that they did not compensate by supplementing or eating other foods fortified with vitamin D. So here's the idea. If you're lactose intolerant, make sure that your body has plenty of vitamin D. Generally, 3 to 4,000 units a day would be outstanding. And in some cases, then if you switch to an organic dairy, you can sometimes are able to tolerate it. Now, one way to help prevent cataracts, according to this study from Khon Kaen University in Thailand, is eating corn. And mind you, we're always talking about non-genetically engineered corn. And I think it's very important that they found that they could help prevent cataracts with this because we know that certain foods like the carotenoids, carrots, and by the way, for the people in this audience who have animals, I've been rescuing animals for a long time, more than 3,000. I rescue them, get them healthy, and find them homes or let them out in the wild. And one of the very first things I see is people who have horses, they're not feeding them carrots. You got to give them organic carrots. Carrots provide them with the vitamin A. Watermelon is great. I've yet to find a horse or a mule that doesn't love watermelon. The seeds, the rind, you wash it down, and always wash the food you give an animal if it's a fruit or vegetable. And you can't assume that it's clean or somehow their bodies can handle it. But I have found that the carotenoids can bring a sick animal back to health, got mange, got a bad coat, losing hair. 3 months, suddenly they got a new coat of hair, helping their gums that were bleeding and no longer bleeding. So carrots every day, depending upon the size of the animal, anywhere from 3 to 5 pounds of carrots and the half a watermelon. Yeah, watch how they go for it and grow your own so it saves a lot of money and you can also just enjoy it. The food yourself. But anyhow, corn is also good if it's organic corn. Now, cataracts, we know, are terrible because they cause blurring and affect the ability to see colors correctly. Unhealthy lifestyle choices, excessive alcohol, smoking, poor diet, also leading to diabetes, can also contribute to cataract formation. And diabetes puts people at a higher risk of cataract. And why? It's called oxidative stress. That's caused by free radicals, and almost all diabetics I counsel have lots of oxidative stress, including diabetic eyes, hypertension, and frequently blindness due to cataract or macular degeneration. So by having as a part of a diet corn that's organic, and you can, hey, take some organic corn and mix it into some stir-fried rice, add in some garlic, just slightly translucent, never brown, and you have yourself a great dish. But get that in there, because it's evidently the pigment found in the yellow corn is helping with the eye. And this was published in Oxidative Medicine and Cellular Longevity. And finally, switching to a low glycemic, that's sugar, diet may stop age-related eye diseases, from Tufts University. Now, we know that macular degeneration can be arrested by switching from a high to a low starch, meaning white bread, that's bad, that's high. White pastas, bad. Go to a dark pasta that has the whole fiber on it. Go to whole grains that are low glycemic, and you can have much better health of your eyes. So that's important. Whole grains instead of processed grains. One last thing from the New York Academy of Sciences. Ginger, in this new study, was found to help all kinds of related diseases to obesity. And ginger, by the way, is, we've known for a long time, is helping to regulate fat metabolism. It helps suppress carbohydrate digestion. It's modulating insulin secretion and response. It's inhibiting oxidative stress. It's lowering blood pressure, and it's lowering cholesterol. Plus, it's also helping settle the stomach. So for all these reasons, my suggestion, you can take ginger, maybe a 4 or 5 ounce piece that'll last you a week. And each day, cut off one section and juice it. Raw ginger juice with 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar and 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice in the morning. Wow. So good for you. Terrific for you. I've had people call me and say, Gary, I had pain in my joints. I had pain in my muscles. I woke up in the morning and looked down and my ankles were swollen. And then I started doing those juices you talk about. And after a week, no more swelling, no more pain in my ankles, my muscles. And what I have people do, everyone, when they're starting to cleanse and detoxify, I start with 16 ounces of green apple, to which is added 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon of ginger juice, fresh made, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice, that's a juice of about 2 lemons, and then you drink that down. Now, later in the day, I have a different juice. I have grapefruit, lemon, lime, and watermelon, and that's detoxifying. And then in smaller quantities, like 1 to 2 ounces, wheatgrass, a couple times a day, and you're chelating toxic metals out, lead, cadmium, aluminum, and you're helping the body go to a more an alkaline base than an acidic state, and you're feeling terrific. So that's some of the things that we should know. All good. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more. Come out of here on the floor. Honey, let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out. Ah, my mama moved up. Honey, move back.
Jackie Wilson. One of my hobbies is to produce a documentary on the life of Jackie Wilson. Anyone in this audience who knows someone who knows Jackie Wilson, when I come back to the city in a couple weeks, I'll be working through the summer on a hobby. I'm doing these really hard-hitting, socially relevant documentaries, and two of the most hard-hitting in my career I'm doing right now. And I'm finished with one. It's in post-production. I'll release it this summer. The other I'll finish in the summer. I'll release in the fall. But in the interim, for those who want to work on a documentary, learn how. I'm willing to do an apprenticing where I show people how to write script, how to produce, direct, finish, post-production, a documentary. It'd be kind of fun. I can't work with a lot of people, but I'll work with maybe 3 or 4. So if you're interested in learning how to do documentary, you can send a letter to my call my office and let them know, and then when I get back into town, I'll have a meeting, see who's really on board and who wants to learn. By the way, my webinar is filled. I'm sorry for those who are not able to get on it, but I told you every lecture premiere down in Houston, we filled the theater, final showing of the Houston Film Festival, and we won Best of Festival, the special jury award for Plant Codes. So when we do these, you got to get in early. But as of right now, we're full for this Sunday night, 7 o'clock webinar and slowing down and reversing the aging process naturally. And I've asked my IT person, is there any way to get even another 1,000 people who can come on board? And he's trying, but right now we're full. But this is going to be a wonderful evening. And by the way, people keep asking my office, how long is it going to be? Never ask me how long my lectures are. I go until I don't have anything more to say. Could be two, could be 3 hours, and including a film, and including answering people's questions on the aging process. Now, I'm going to do a special on menopause on that as well. Tonight on the Progressive Commentary Hour, wow, what a topic. The erosion of the Constitution under Trump, a case for criminal conspiracy, and how private firms are usurping government and civil rights. Who's my guest? One of the best, Danny Sheehan, one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. And if you don't know Danny Sheehan, whoa. The Pentagon Papers would never have been published without him. The Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Karen Silkwood's murder case, Three Mile Island nuclear disaster. All these issues, you'll find Danny Sheehan was a part. So that's half of tonight. The other half, we're waiting for a special report from a correspondent that we have just getting out of Syria. If this person can get to a landline, we will tell you the truth, which is completely different than all the other people, including Democracy Now!, who seems to be, for whatever their ideology or reasoning, supporting the imperialism and the pro-war positions of the every administration, especially with Libya and with Syria. But we can assure you that we're going to rip through all of those guests who appeared on all those other programs lying about Syria and Assad and what was going on. And we have a special person who's just returning from Libya who's going to tell you what really went on, how many people actually died, and how many people on the left and Obama and Hillary Clinton and the so-called corporate Democrat liberal community supported what is just a massacre there and total destruction. And why? For what purpose? So we're going to get into that. So we have some interesting progressive commentary hours. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, here we have Trump. I've suggested that instead of being constantly angry at the man and his administration, that it would do us all well to start looking at issues that we, the people, at a local level, and then joining with coalitions of others, agree that there are some things that we should take on that matter, that we have in our control, not their corporate control. For example, I believe that we should reform our entire prison system. I believe that everyone that has been in jail for a crime of drugs should be, unless it's murder, should be let out, their records expunged, and brought back into the society. I also believe that we should begin the process of forgiving massive debt, because we forgave the debt of the most irresponsible financial experts in history. Turns out they weren't very expert because they failed to see that they were in a bubble from Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke and all the others, Treasury secretaries. They didn't see it coming. They should have. For those who were responsible and getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, I believe we should be a massive national campaign to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act and a massive national campaign to get rid of Citizens United. I believe that we should get money out of politics so that the average person can trust our system because we can get 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 20th party people in there sharing points of view. So I believe that instead of just putting everything into anger towards a person and administration, but never having seen the limitations or the duplicity of previous administrations that might have been more charming and likable, but much more lethal, I believe we should start putting into positive resolutions. But we also have to be very careful what we're dealing with when it comes to a Donald Trump. Remember, you're not just dealing with Trump as an individual. You're dealing with all the people around Trump, all of whom have something to gain by being a part of his cabinet. Plus, you have the people that you do not know, have never heard of them, and there are about 400,000 private military industrial contractors and lobbyists who gain when Trump is in power, or Obama is in power, or Clinton would have been in power, like Reagan was in power. They have so many of their bases covered. One thing we can, I believe, all agree upon. Donald Trump's election has sparked a heated debate about the past, particularly over whether the Trump administration represents a continuum, if not an echo, of the protean origins of fascism. Now, this is just not an existential issue, and I think Henry Giroux sums it up best. This is an argument that combines the resources of historical memory with the current analysis of the distinctive temper of a new and dangerous historical moment in the United States. Let me be specific. An increasing number of pundits across the ideological spectrum have identified Trump as a fascist or neo-fascist, while resurrecting some of the key messages of an earlier period of fascist politics. On the left of the liberal side of the politics, this includes writers like Chris Hedges and Robert Reich and Cornel West and Drusilla Cornell and Peter Dreyer and John Bellamy Foster. Similar arguments have been made on the conservative side by writers such as Robert Kagan, Jeet Heer, Meg Whitman, and Charles Sykes. Historians of fascism such as Timothy Snyder and Robert Paxton have argued that Trump is not Hitler, but there are sufficient and similar qualities between them to warrant some concerns about surviving elements of a totalitarian past crystallizing into new forms in the United States. Paxton in particular argues that the Trump regime is closer to a plutocracy than fascism. But I think Paxton overplays the differences between fascism and Trump's style of authoritarianism, particularly underemphasizing Trump's ultra-nationalism, his militarism, and his authoritarianism, particularly underemphasizing Trump's ultra-nationalism and his embrace of the neoliberal state, which does not suggest the rule of free market capitalism, but a more extreme example of a corporate state. What do I mean? Think of Mussolini in the 1920s. Mussolini called the corporatist state, and he did so because he knew that corporations, working with people in government at the highest levels, created their own set of directives, their own laws. In this case, traditional state power has been replaced by the rule of major corporations and the financial elite. At the same time, the social cleansing and state violence inherent in totalitarianism has been amplified under Trump. Both Hannah Arendt and Sheldon Wolin, who we had on this program, Wolin, in one of his last interviews, great historian of totalitarianism, have argued that the conditions that produce authoritarian logics have persisted well after their mid-20th century expressions. Wolin, in particular, insisted in 2010 that the United States was evolving into an authoritarian society. So recently, though, numerous critics have denied the persistence of fascism and totalitarianism. They have argued that Trump is either a sham, a right-wing populist, or simply a reactionary Republican. Three notable examples of the latter positions could be found in the work of cultural critic Neil Gabler, who argues that Trump is mostly a self-promoting con artist and pretender president whose greatest crime is to elevate pretense and self-promotion and appearance over substance, all of which proves that he lacks the capacity and the will to govern. Andrea O'Hare claims we have to choose between whether Trump is just a clown or a fascist dictator, and in the end seems to pivot more towards the clown argument, though he admits Trump is nonetheless dangerous. I believe that a more sophisticated version of this argument can be found in the work of historian Victoria de Grazia, who has argued that Trump bears little direct resemblance to either Hitler or Mussolini and is just a reactionary conservative. Now, certainly Trump is not Hitler, and the United States is, at the current historical moment, is not the Weimar Republic. But it would be a response, clown, or an aberration given his hold on power and the ideologues who support him. What appears indisputable is that Trump's election is part of a sustained effort over the last 40 years on the part of the financial elite to undermine the democratic ethos and hijack the institutions that support it. Consequently, in the midst of the rising tyranny of totalitarian politics, democracy is on life support, and its fate appears more uncertain than ever. And such an acknowledgement should make clear that the curse of totalitarianism is not a historical relic, and that it is crucial that we learn something about the current political moment by examining how the spread of authoritarianism has become the crisis of our times, albeit in a form suited to the American context. Now, you've heard me mention many times on this program that I do not see in the mainstream media, and I do not regularly see in the alternative media, with some exceptions like Consortium News and Op-Ed and Countercurrents, etc., I do not see any interest in the invasiveness, the perniciousness of the surveillance state. I do not see demonstrations against the National Defense Authorization Act, with only one exception, with Chris Hedges and some others went down to Washington, allowed themselves to be arrested, and then sued the government. They ultimately lost, but not on the merits of their case, but rather on technicalities. And yet this is an act that could allow any person in the United States to be arrested for any reason the president thought fit. No habeas corpus, no due process. You wouldn't be told what you're being arrested for. You could be spending the rest of your life in prison. No one would know it. You would have no ability to defend yourself, nor to meet those who challenged you. And if the president wanted, he could have you shot and do so with impunity, even if you had not been found guilty of anything. Now imagine that kind of power, and you think that, well, surely someone as sophisticated socially and as arguably as charming as Obama and as a constitutional lawyer and professor, he would have been adamantly opposed to that. Well, no, he was the one who created it. That's what's amazing to me, is that some of the most criminal, unethical, immoral laws and signing statements and executive orders came under a man who has completely disarmed the entire corporate left. He lied, but because he was a charming liar, people liked him, just like Bill Clinton. Now, they don't hold the same fondness for Hillary Clinton, nor some other people, nor George Bush. But keep in mind, Clinton won 2 terms, Obama won 2, Bush won 2. So we are not able, as a society yet, the majority of people are not yet able to look at something for what it is. Instead, we look at what we would like it to be or what we're told it should be. History, once again, offers us a framework in which the global constellation of authoritarian, economic, social, and political forces are coming together that speak to tensions and contradictions animating everyday lives that transcend national boundaries, for which there is not yet a comprehensive, coherent, and critical language. What has emerged is a climate of precarity, fear, angst, paranoia, and incendiary passion. And drawing upon Hannah Arendt's, it would be wise to resurrect one of the key questions that emerges from her work on totalitarianism, which is whether the events of our time are leading to totalitarian rule. So today I'm going to end with just one thought. If you think we are not in a police state, if you believe that it would be foolish to consider us a totalitarian state, after all, we have all these freedoms, then ask yourself this. What kind of freedom is it that allows a police officer to pull you over and then confiscate everything that you have at that moment. You confiscate your car, all of the cash you have on you. They have a machine which can take out the money from your credit cards without charging you with a single crime. And how much did they steal? Over $3.5 billion, with a B, billion dollars. And that is considered normal. And yet not a single one of those officers were challenged. And what about the 80,000 SWAT raids, which now more than ever are being to collect bills? And what about the debtors' prisons, where people are going to prison for no other reason than they can't pay a bill? So we take someone that is economically stressed, someone who's under a great deal of pressure to pay a bill, but they have no more means to pay it. They're out of money. So we arrest them and then charge them for arresting them, putting them into a privatized prison, seeing a privatized judge, and going before a privatized probation officer. And if they can't pay it, it's compounded. Now their whole family is held accountable. Better pay the bill or mom doesn't get out of jail. Debtors' prisons ended in 1833 or in Dixonian England a little later. And yet we have them back today and no one's talking about it. Maybe they are. Maybe they're marches. Maybe they're demonstrations. I'm just kind of clueless on this, but I haven't seen a single one. I haven't seen a march against the people who are in prison because they were using marijuana. I haven't seen that march. I haven't seen the march against the National Defense Authorization Act, the spying on every single one of our communications, even doing it against the law. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen a march in support of all the homeless people and all the people on food stamps who are food deprived. I haven't seen marches to stop the bees from being given neonicotinoids or neonics that can destroy up to 60% of an entire beehive, and one third of all of our food comes from them. I haven't seen demonstrations against money in politics, yet I have seen people seemingly losing their minds because they don't like a particular liberal or conservative speaker at a college and engaging in violence to prevent that person from speaking. If we really believe in freedom of speech, then we have to accept that we're going to hear things we don't like, but that doesn't mean we accept them. Because the moment you decide that you don't want someone of a particular ethnic or cultural or political or sexual identity background lecturing, that's censorship. And censorship is always the handmaiden to fascism. And sooner or later, it could be you that could be the one who is told, we don't like you. You're one of those health nuts. You don't believe in mandatory vaccines. You're a danger to society. Well, friend, if you believe that, then let us look at the evidence together. There is no need to attack each other. This is not a blood sport. I'm not here to denigrate you. I'm merely here to share a point of view. Look at my information and see whether or not my scholarship warrants a reappraisal of your thoughts. I'm happy to look at your research that proves they're safe and effective. Now take that to every other area of life, and you realize what a slippery slope we're dealing with. And the left in particular, you're about one heartbeat away from losing all credibility on everything. It seems to be just tearing itself apart. Be for something that empowers people. Just don't be against other people. Because at a certain point, your self-righteous indignation, your rage, and your ability not to distinguish between protecting the freedom of speech of some, but not those you disagree with, is going to be a mirror that will be held against you. So whether or not Trump is a fascist in the exact manner of earlier totalitarian leaders somewhat misses the point, because it suggests that fascism is a historically fixed doctrine rather than an ideology that mutates and expresses itself in different forms around a number of commonalities. And there is no exact blueprint for fascism, though echoes of its past haunt contemporary politics. And I believe that we should be paying more attention to this than we have in the past. Because from my perspective, since I'm aware of it, then I see it. And when I see people who have no background, none whatsoever, running whole agencies of government, when the new FDA commissioner is a radio host with no science background at all, Well, what exactly could go wrong if you're the head of an agency that's supposed to have a deep understanding of science, and up to this point, virtually all the heads of that agency have been compromised by special interest groups to protect their product, their proprietary interest. So we need objective, honest, independent science that's for the people. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to say hello to all of you, to all the syndicated stations and people listening around the world. When I return to the city, we're going to have a brand new studio with big monitors going from floor to ceiling. And instead of showing you bad things happening around the world, I'm going to show you nature at its best. Something different I haven't seen before. Thought of this idea, and now we're engineers and IT people are putting it together. And we're going to be showing you. Right now, I'm going to play you some audio clips, but now you'll be able to see the audio clips. And my guests are going to be on Skype, so you can see them as well. So we got a whole new visual coming up. Now let's listen to supporting our mom and pop independent farms.
You know who gets screwed that nobody talks about? And I'll be honest, I blame Democrats for this as well as Republicans. Is small business owners are getting screwed, and they have been screwed for 30 years. And you see it. And the independent business owners, I know, they blame themselves. They think it's something they did wrong, that they didn't know about something, or they budgeted wrong for energy. But right now, and this is something very important for Democrats to understand, the red tape is real. Too many regulations, that is real. And so many of those come from big company lobbyists who are quite happy to have their ginormous company pay $300 for a fee, but that fee is going to kill your independent business owner on top of all the other fees. So there is a real problem, and there is a real problem with the fact that our banks that we bailed them out, and they are not lending to our independent business owners. Our current federal policy on being an independent business owner, on where you get a line of credit, is your credit card or your rich uncle, and most people don't have a rich uncle. So basically our theory is go in debt. That isn't going to work, and this is the heart and soul of our community, is these independent businesses, creative, serving local communities, coming up with new things and figuring out what local people need. And guess what? Money into a small business stays in the community. It is not our independent farmers who are getting support from the federal government. You might think that, but no. Basically, these big lobbyists go in there and they make sure that the subsidies, and 75% of the subsidies, and this is, it's really lopsided, this is accounting for size, go to the big farms. And I'm not talking big, like a big local farm with a reasonable number of cows. I'm talking gigantic companies that don't even care about their animals, that all they care about is Wall Street. So basically, we're making, instead of farming being about farming, farming is about Wall Street, and that's a huge, huge problem. Instead of farming being about farming, farming is about lobbying, and that's a problem. So it makes no sense that we in Ulster County ship our apples to Texas to get sliced up, to get put in little plastic bags, to get shipped back here and served in our McDonald's. We can have local processing. It makes no sense to be bringing in dairy from California where there's a drought when we have the most extraordinary dairy land in the world right here. It kills me seeing all this unused farmland. And it is really important that we stand up for those independent farmers and those independent businesses that have really gotten screwed in the last 30 years.
I certainly support small farmers since I am a small farmer and been teaching farming since 1972. Right now, I'm looking for farmland and to do a place in the summertime for about 14 months a year, where on the weekends, children from inner cities and urban areas can come and learn all about organic, all about how animals should be treated and not eaten and slaughtered. And so in the process now of looking, but I'm finding a lot of places that wouldn't meet my needs for what I'm looking to do, but certainly would be great opportunities, wonderful farmland, good soil, good water. I'm going to make a list of these. And sometime in the next month, I'm going to post them, and so you can just go directly to the brokers and see, you know, about a beautiful big piece of land for like $100,000 with barns and everything. A lot of good stuff out there. So that's coming. Now I'm going to open it up for TalkBack and 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And here's my question for you. What are your thoughts on the war on drugs? What are your thoughts about all the millions of people whose lives have been impacted, not just the person serving time, but their family members, and then they can't live in certain projects, all because of the stupid war on crime, or war on drugs, which has created crime and deaths and gangs and militias? What do you believe we should do? That's my question. 888-874-4888. And now I wanted to hear about this NBC News report on fish in the Pacific.
This next item made a lot of U.S. consumers sit up and take notice today. Bluefin tuna caught off the California coast have been found to contain elevated levels of radioactive matter, dating back to the Japanese earthquake and tsunami that led to that nuclear accident at the Fukushima power plant. I'll report tonight from NBC's Miguel Almaguer.
Today at the San Pedro Fish Market in Southern California, Don Cadota inspects the catch of the day and stressed his fish are safe to eat.
The word radiation creates fear in people.
The 15 bluefin tuna caught and tested off California's coast last summer showed low levels of radiation, but still 10 times higher than normal. Scientists say it's the first time a fast-moving migrating fish has been shown to carry radioactivity from Japanese waters.
We almost didn't believe it, to tell you the truth.
Dr. Nicholas Fisher, professor of marine sciences, co-authored the study.
Every single fish was significantly contaminated with two radioisotopes of cesium. These are common waste products from nuclear accidents.
The research shows the bluefin tuna that spawn and feed in the waters near the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant migrated some 6,000 miles, reaching Southern California just a few months after the disaster. Though the sample fish are contaminated, the levels are far lower than what's considered dangerous.
Today, the FDA said they'll continue to monitor radiation levels in fish, and no public health concern has been detected.
I don't think I'll change the way that I eat, not at the moment.
It's definitely made me alter just a little bit, not eat quite so much.
Look at the tuna jumping right there.
Massive in size, up to 10 feet and weighing more than 1,000 pounds, Pacific bluefin tuna is a delicacy, often eaten as sushi around the world.
Scientists say the real test on how radiation affects migrating fish will come this summer. Researchers will look at fish that have spent more time in contaminated waters and could have even higher levels of pollution.
Here's the unstated message here. If the FDA tells you it's not enough radiation to be posing a threat, then go ahead and eat it. This is the same logic, the same reasoning they were saying about cigarette smoking. It's the same way they said about lead in paint and the chemicals in our air pollution. So do not expect ever the FDA to take the lead in showing you what is wrong with something. It is highly politically motivated. I wouldn't touch anything out of the Pacific. Then you could be on the safe side. John from New York. Hi, John. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. First of all, God bless you. You do such fantastic work, you know, waking people up. And I've been listening to you for some time. You're fantastic. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I have a unique perspective with respect to the question that you asked about the what happens with the drug war. And it's just like all the other wars. It's to enrich certain segments of the population. I actually volunteer and teach meditation in prison, and I've been doing that for a few years. So I do see firsthand what the drug war does. And as far as I'm concerned, anybody who supports that system, I'm talking about our politicians, they should actually be going to jail. And the guys in jail should come out for nonviolent drug offenses. Portugal, some time ago, legalized drugs, and the crime rate went down. So, you know, these certain areas are enriched off of the misery of the poor and minorities, and I see that. So the judicial or the injustice system, the police, and the government that makes these laws, they are the ones that, as far as I'm concerned, should be thrown in prison because of harming so many people in so many ways.
John, I appreciate your insights, and especially since you work with prisoners, so you have a chance to see that. Thank you for your comments. And I might also mention that when we consider what is the purpose of putting someone in jail for 7 years for having a small amount of marijuana? In fact, it's not illegal to possess that marijuana in some states, but the moment police officer says, empty your pockets, and if it were in your pocket, the moment it comes out of the pocket, then they arrest you. And that's a form of entrapment. Stop and searches of over 500,000 New Yorkers each year, 90% of them people of color. That is, in my opinion, racial profiling and is part of our racist society. But it also means that we are desensitizing the police in their training to what it means to be a human being. I saw about 2 years ago, I saw some footage that really concerned me. A student down at University of Texas, Austin, was just walking across the street. Now, it was on the campus, but they were jaywalking. They didn't walk at the corner. They walked the middle. Big deal. There was no cars, and there was some police there, and they went over, and they tackled the person. And they handcuffed, beat him up, and arrested him for jaywalking. Why? What is the purpose of that? Because once you give people power, you cannot in any way control the outcome of the use of that power. And I believe that our entire policing system, which has been militarized, has to be completely redone. So the police are there for one reason only, to protect and to serve. So anyone could walk up to a police officer at any time, ask them a question, if they needed help with something that was important and that was part of that police officer's duty to help them. I do not believe that we should have SWAT teams engaged except where there is a legitimate, you know, cause like a kidnapping or someone who's on a murder rampage. But for processing bills, you're going to break in people's doors, you're going to shoot their dogs, frequently shooting the person. No, it shouldn't be done. And on that case, I'd like to share something from David Rosen. This is from Counterpunch. It's short. It talks about, quoting from a new report from the ACLU and the Human Rights Watch, every 25 seconds, the human toll for criminalization of drugs in the United States occurs. Every 25 seconds, someone is arrested for possessing drugs for their own use. Amounting to 250,000 arrests per year. Quote, these numbers tell a tale of ruined lives, destroyed families, and communities suffering under a suffocating police presence, end quote. Now, the study is an impressive piece of rigorous research and analysis, as well as a statement of moral conviction. It's a political call to decriminalize all personal drug use, my caller John from New York correctly stated. In Portugal, crime was reduced by over 50%, and other problems such as hepatitis B that you can get from infected needles also went down because people are getting treated. So what we see in America is we see a devastating portrait of not simply a nation's failed anti-drug policy, but reveals it to be a mean-spirited, moralistic, and racist program of social repression. I'll conclude today by just sharing a few. As I mentioned, every 25 seconds, someone in the United States is arrested. Sadly, more than 1.2 million people are arrested each year. More than one out of every nine arrests by state law enforcement is for drug possession. Four times more people are arrested for possessing drugs than for selling them. And there are at least 137,000 men and women in prison for drug possession. And that does not include in local jails. And this population consists predominantly of inner city dwellers, African-Americans and Hispanic, and largely youthful offenders. In 42 states, possession of tiny amounts of most illicit drugs other than marijuana is either always or sometimes a felony offense. Only eight states in the District of Columbia make possession of small amounts of misdemeanor. And state rates of arrest for drug possession range from 700 per 100,000 people in Maryland to 77 in Vermont. Well, a bust every 25 seconds adds up. As the study reminds us, quote, tens of thousands of people are convicted, cycle through jails and prisons, and spend extended periods of time on probation and parole, often burdened with crippling debt from court-imposed fines and fees. And the study makes clear that the war on drugs is a putative, vindictive form of policing, criminal justice, and imprisonment. Look, it's easy, like Jeff Sessions, to be tough on those involved in mostly a victimless crime, drug use. Cops pick the easiest target, notably inner-city minority with stop and frisk. And increasingly rural white youth, prosecutors show off how they're tough and throwing the book at these helpless souls. These people need help, not prison. I believe that we should get rid of this absolutely worthless, counterproductive cancer that's on the psyche of the American public. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.